nerds and gig lovers. I am Kirky, your gig mistress, and I promised I would bring some cool content to you, did I not? With me today, I have Barry Hyde. You are a... Hi, how are you doing?
I'm okay, thank you. Spring has sprung.
Spring has sprung. We have daylight, because the last recording I did, I kept my window shut because it was dark and I just looked like a vampire. So it was just, yeah, spring is here. Let's have some daylight.
Well, you're obviously not a vampire, because otherwise you'd be dead because it's daytime.
Well, that's what you think. Maybe I've just got really good sun cream on.
I suppose vampires could evolve.
Evolve? Daywalkers? We're going a bit Blade territory there, aren't we? A bit. Oh, I like it. Total local legend. Total local legend. Total legends in general.
Well, that's what my mum thinks.
Mums are never wrong. I'm a mum. We're never wrong.
Well, I owe my mum and dad everything, really. But I suppose in terms of music in Sunderland, quite well known and gaining experience all the time. So that's my way of saying that I'm getting on a bit.
So, Matt, humble. You're so humble straight away for somebody who is so well-known and so musically talented. You are so humble straight away.
You know what? I mean, you know, the Future Heads is a band that I created with some friends and in the year 2000. And, you know, we had an amazing experience of, you know, getting record deals and, you know, you might say success and become famous. But I think being from Sunderland, you know, it's easy to keep your feet on the ground. And also in terms of being humble about skills, I just think the only real talent is enthusiasm. And, you know, that's what allows people to gain skill. So, I'm just a well-experienced musician who's enthusiastic about it, but I haven't always been enthusiastic. There's been periods of my life when I've been very unenthusiastic about music and subsequently moved into other areas like becoming a chef.
Shock, a chef, I can't cook. So, yeah. What? Was there any sort of catalyst behind sort of becoming a chef? Was it something different? Was it a break? And because I know a lot of musicians, they sometimes do that. They sometimes just go, right, I need space. And
yeah, that happened to me. I mean, I was kind of like, I'm trying to think timeline-wise. The band had been together for a while, maybe it's like 12 years. And I just kind of became disillusioned with music and being a professional musician. And had to stop. I had to kind of create the space in my life for the things to come into it. Mm-hmm. And then as is typical with life, as soon as I stopped, I wanted to do it again.
I can relate to this. I was a live music photographer for a long, long time, and I photographed two bands off the belt. And I was like, I feel like I've really achieved this now. I am done. I've photographed The Sisters of Mercy and then Killing Joke one after the other. And I was like, I am. Here, I'm done. This is like top notch. And then I got very disillusioned with it very quickly. And I was like, that's it. I need something new. And then the second I got out of it, I was like, I want to do it again. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was kind of like a little gap in the thing about it is, but if you're a professional artist, right, it's a difficult living. They call it the hardest way to make an easy living, but it's possibly the easiest way to make a hard living. You know, so we were kind of experiencing feast or famine. So in terms of building a life, it was challenging for us to be able to, well, especially for me, to kind of ground myself as a responsible person, because I was living a kind of bohemian life and some kind of Peter Pan existence. And so many professional musicians I know are very strange and eccentric people, because they, you know, when I got a publishing deal, and bearing in mind it wasn't a huge amount of money, but when I stopped being on a payroll when I was in my early 20s, my life changed. I have never had a boss. The last time I had a boss, I was working in a supermarket on the dairy section. And that was a completely different person to who I am now. So, You know, like my brother, for example, who joined the band when he was only 16, you know, he's never had a job. There's my son. He's never had a job, really, you know, and that's not, and that's difficult, you know.
Yes.
But, you know, but this is, they call it living the dream. And it is somewhat of a dream to be able to play music, but somewhat of a nightmare to have to rely on it to make a living.
Yes. I think people have this perception where you start a job, start a music industry career, and it's all party and you glamour and glitz. And the same with the any art industry. They think it's all going to just land in your lap and you're going to get a record label and you're going to get this. And it's party, party, party. And it is absolutely not that at all. Hey, you know, it's a lot of hard work and a lot of effort in any creative industry. Like you said before, when you referenced it, it's any creative industry. You're very passionate about music in general, aren't you? Just overall, yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of a music nerd.
Yes, that's what we want, nerds. Go on, tell me all about it.
Well, I mean, I suppose so much of a music nerd that me and my business partner, who's called Dan Donnelly, who's in a band called Levelers, have written and owned a Bachelor of the Arts degree. And it's in part, we're delivering it in partnership with Sunderland University. And so that's about as nerdy as you get.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. I think music education is a really important thing. And I think, did you launch that during the pandemic? Wasn't that something?
We had to launch, the course is called Modern Music Industries, right? And it is essentially, we think of it as like a training course in some of the different areas of the music industry. So that's like, obviously, traditional music, musician skills, entrepreneurialism, event management, music production. We've got Peter Brewis from Field Music as our music production lecturer.
Amazing.
And that's really good. But, you know, we kind of had to launch it when it was illegal to play music indoors. So, and we'd spent 5 years of our lives at that point trying to establish it. And we honestly thought, me and Dan thought, we'd basically ruined our lives, sincerely. We were like, oh my God, there's no live music industry. Obviously, the record industry kind of died a couple of decades ago, really, in terms of, if you think of an industry as something that produces something, and the record industry is producing records, which are physical objects, and that really doesn't exist in the same way that it did. But live music was the thing that we were kind of, that's the thing that we make money from as artists, and it was a scary time. But we did manage to get like a small cohort together for the first year of delivery. And now we're in our third year and we have something like 52 students. So it's gone well. It's gone really well. But we have a cool kind of approach, I think, to how we run our school, which is effectively a partner college. And we use some interesting spaces such as the Peacock. We've created what's called Birdland Studios, which is the top floor of this Edwardian. We call it the Edwardian Fortress. It's a massive...
I know it well.
All right. Well, it was a nefarious pub called the Londonderry Hotel. And it's been there since 1901, so I guess it's been all sorts of establishments. But towards the end days of the Derry, it had become quite, well, I can say that it was run down because I had to scrub all the black mould off the wall in the attic, which had had a hole in it for God knows how long. So I would class that as run down.
Yeah. Run down. No, because that is now your landlord of it, aren't you?
Me and my wife run the pub, We run a hospitality business on the side to the music school. So it's all about partnerships, though, to be honest. It's like, I've always relied on partnerships. But I suppose when I was younger, I ended up with some personal problems with mental health because I didn't realise that I was in a partnership. I thought it was all about my efforts. So as I'm a bit older now, I feel I'm always looking out for good pals, partners, to do things with, you know, and make things happen with. I think it's important to to realize you're part, to be part of a team, even if it's just a two-person team.
You mentioned obviously the BA honors course, music education going forward, because you've said you're quite liberal with it. My experience with music education was classical. I was trained with a violin, classical, kind of put through the ringer, you know, vocal training, stuff like that.
It
didn't tick for me. Do you think changing the music industry and music, how it's taught is vital? Do you think it's vital to bring in new people rather than alienating with, say, traditional?
Well, I think if you're talking about classical music, the systems of classical music are essential, and they have to be kept and maintained, because that's, you know, what I love about the tradition of classical music and notation and, you know, the theory behind it all, is that when we're starting to think about music on those terms, we're really starting to get an insight into the great composers and how they would approach music, you know. But it can be quite alienating for most people who aren't in a position whereby they can start getting lessons from a young age. And I mean, I couldn't afford music. We couldn't afford music lessons for me when I was a kid. But my dad just bought a piano from the Sunderland Echo for £5. And we brought it into the house, and it stank of beer and cigarettes, because it had been in a pub for God knows how long. And that was my first musical instrument. And
piano.
Yeah, when I was about 8 years old. And then I kind of became interested in playing football and less kind of isolating activities, and then got bang into music when I was 15. And for me, when I discovered that there was this like BTEC in popular music happening, I just couldn't believe that. I went from doing my GCSEs and that to getting up every day, getting me a guitar, putting it on my back, and getting a bus to Shiny Roll and studying music every day. I just couldn't believe that's what I was doing with my time, you know? And I was like really into it. But thinking back, that old model of delivering level three, it's still basically how it's done up to even BA level. And that's basically this. You put together some musicians who are strangers, and you kind of coerce them into being ensembles, and you give them a set list. And it's always bloody Superstition by Stevie Wonder. And it's like, and whatever else, you know, and it never works, because, you know, young people can be unreliable. You might have one drummer, so they're going to have to be in five bands. You might have too many guitarists. Well, you'll definitely have too many guitarists. And then, you know, and it just doesn't work. It doesn't function as a learning environment. It's more like people just end up having squabbles.
Yes.
About it. And that's not how it works. So we don't do that. Our model is we pay for our students to have private lessons as part of their course.
Right.
And so that's 1 hour per week. This is on top of all of the other modules. We pay for them to have private lessons with an expert in what they're looking at. So if it's like a kind of guitar wizard type, we put them with a guy called Nick Jennison, who's like a virtuoso rock master. Or if we have someone who wants to do songwriting, I might take them, or keyboards, or we've got a great drum teacher, we've got a vocal coach, and we reinvest some of their tuition money straight back into them. And no one does that, because it's very expensive.
Yes, it is.
But it's bloody expensive, because it's £25 an hour, right? And for 24 hours per academic year, that's a lot of money. What we're finding is that they're becoming better musicians, and then they're more likely to form their own ensembles and bands. And we're getting organic bands forming. And of course, we do like an event management module, which is basically organizing a gig. And inevitably, they form bands to get on stage for that purpose of that gig. And then they concentrate on their other work. So to answer your question, you know, I think music education needs a balance between understanding the concepts and rules of music, but also with creating an environment where artists can develop. The thing is about, you know, classical music, you could say an orchestra is a, just a massive covers band, you know, and they're playing exquisite music.
Yes.
But is it creative? I don't know. It's productive. It's reproductive, but they're not they're creating the sound, but they're not creating what sound is, in as much as, you know, but you still get genius classical musicians. So it's like, there's something going on there. But I teach music theory in the second trimester, and I love it.
You love music theory?
I do, because the students are absolutely clamming for it, because they can play, but they don't really know what they're doing. And to show them, you know, tell them about how the major scale works and the key signatures and get them into that, it's like, it's very interesting for me, because when it doesn't instantly click, sometimes it doesn't click at all, but when it starts to click, when the penny starts to drop and you see this like elevation of understanding from a musician, it reminds me of when that happened to me, when I start to study the chromatic scale and things like modulation and the ancient Greek modes. And I'm like, ah, this is kind of making sense a bit more now.
And it sort of brings back for you that feeling as well, because you're seeing that happen to somebody else and you're like, the potential that you are seeing in front of you, you're growing that. And that's got to be a really good achievement in yourself.
Well, indeed. But at the end of the day, right, they have to do the work. They have to do the self-development. And what I like to think of as, you know, like, and the process of becoming an artist is a process of understanding yourself.
Yes.
You know, and we're all unique people. And I suppose the great art that's been made is infused with the uniqueness of a person. But if you don't know yourself, you can't become an artist. It's impossible, because what you're going to produce, it will mean nothing.
We'd be reproducing. And funny enough, this is a conversation I had with a visual artist not so long ago, and I was kind of sort of saying, they're already there. You know, they know themselves, they know what they like, they know their style. And it's the same with music. You know what you like, you know your style. You have to run with that, because if you don't, and you don't draw on what you love, how can you create something? You generally end up just recreating. Again, a little bit like the orchestra. Are you changing it? Are you rewriting it? Are you, you know, adjusting the... I have forgotten the technical word for it. The, you know, how it's set out. Are you going to do something crazy? Like, there was an album released, a classical music album released with remixes on by people like Mr. Scruff, and they took some Steve Reich stuff and they mixed it up with some other artists. That kind of thing. But again, you're reworking, aren't you? It's called reworks. You're reworking, whereas bringing new, fresh creativity out. Do you think that there's a lot more people thinking that they can learn from, say, like YouTube? Or
of course.
Do you think that
YouTube's,
works?
YouTube's amazing, you know. There's some of the teachers on there. Springs to mind a guy called Rick Beato. Rick Beato's like incredible. Like, his knowledge is like unfathomable, really. And the guy's basically a studio engineer, multi-instrumentalist guy. And I'm like looking at his lectures that he puts together, and I'm like, it's incredible that that's there. It's like having access to a genius teacher that you're never going to meet. You know, when I was learning to be a musician, I used to go to the library.
I used to go to the
Metro Centre and buy books. You know, we get these young musicians coming in, and they've basically specialised themselves via YouTube deep dives, and, you know, and they've got streaming services, and it's like, what's your favorite Led Zeppelin album? They're like, who are Led Zeppelin? I'm like, what the hell? I mean, you know, there used to be like a kind of standardized path to becoming a guitarist, for example, and it would involve Hendrix and Zeppelin and, you know, all of the gods. But now it's not the same. It's so sporadic and individualistic that you might get a great musician who's only ever listened to one band and they just love them. But that's another thing. I mean, I find the more the merrier with influencers, really. But a lot of people don't think like that. But a lot of people, you know, can't eat a lot of different foods.
Yes, there's this. This is sort of, you know, I have an incredibly eclectic music taste, and a lot of the nerdy up north lot have an incredibly eclectic music taste. And this is something that I've noticed with the younger generation. particularly with my little boy. He has got, he's got streaming sites. He's got sites where he can access just about any genre of music. It's not like back in sort of my day where I would go to HMV and I would go and stand in, say, the music heavy metal section, and I would go through and I would pick solely them bands. I necessarily wouldn't venture into the pop section or the classical or anything like that, because that wasn't what I was seen to be my genre. I would be sitting there with my Metallica album, my Number of the Beast by Iron Maiden. I would be sat there trying to work my way through all of that, you know?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So this is what we call, well, it's what is personal research. So, you know, like one of our, the interesting conversations we have about, because we're launching a master's degree in September. So we've had to like get that ratified. And it's like, what's not really taken as, what's not really considered by universities with musicians is personal research that essentially we start doing usually when we're 13. So that counts, you know, like that counts towards our current skill set, you know, and we're studious about it, you know. Musicians have to be comfortable with a certain element of loneliness, maybe. To that kind of isolation of being with the instrument, you know, and being with me surrounded by music. It's kind of like a some amazing coping mechanism for all sorts of things in life, you know. So it's always fascinating to me. But we put on a lot of gigs, you know, and I'll tell you what I love is getting rockabilly bands to come play in the Peacock.
Yes.
Because the musicianship's so slick and it's not too heavy. Often there's only half a drum kit, you know, and there's like a guitarist who's not using distortion, and there's hardly even any chords. It's all these little kind of lines, you know, and it works really well. And occasionally we get put Irish folk music on, and that's just amazing. It's like kind of bluegrass. It's like pro bluegrass, you know, and it's so difficult to play. I'm really searching for gypsy jazz musicians, but there's just none of them. I think it's just beyond most human beings to be able to play gypsy jazz because it's just so tricky.
Yes. As jazz is in general, I find jazz eludes me quite a lot. But I think to find that, and if you could, how cool would that be? Because this is one of the things that I noticed when I was looking up and doing my research as well, because obviously a big part of this is my research. I've got to learn about what I'm going into, because I can sit in my own little bubble, no problem at all. You put on a lot of, like you said, eclectic music at the Peacock, but you also support a lot of really up-and-coming bands, putting on people that, you know, giving them that opening. Is that really important to you, especially for your business side, the Peacock itself?
Well, you know, I sometimes worry about the youth of today. Because whenever I see like a young person walking down the street with a guitar, you know, I kind of cherish them. And I'm seeing more and more. And that's really good because we need musicians. We need people who aren't following a kind of mainstream path of life, which is not to disparage people that do. But every society needs to have artists. And obviously, from my perspective, I have to respect the music industry structure of Sunderland and the place where real fledgling grassroots musicians should go to. It's not to me. It should be going to the Bunker and to see Kenny Sanger, because they've got 17 rehearsal rooms. They should be going to see someone like Laura Brewis, who's doing the Young Musicians Project down at the Field Music's studio. And she's got loads of participants who are learning how to write songs. Oh. And then when they get to the point where they are ready to maybe do a gig or do a recording session, I might start to meet them. If they want to do a degree, then I definitely want to meet them.
Come and join the degree.
I think it's all about, you know, with Sunderland, just the music business infrastructure is so strong now, because, you know, in the year 2000, when I formed the Future Heads, there was not actually a music venue in Sunderland other than the Sunderland Empire, which was a bit big. It's like 1800. And there was just a load of like pub function rooms with carpets. And it's like, carpets do not belong in music venues.
Oh. You do not
want carpets in your music venue for many reasons. One of them being it makes the room sound very dull, and also they get completely filthy. But now I honestly lose count of the amount of performance spaces that are good in Sunderland. There must be like 15 of them. And that's really great because that's the tangible focus point for the young, not just young musicians, any musicians, but we need to bring them through. I think it's really positive what's going on at the minute.
Yeah.
With regards to hopefully when we change government soon, with regards to what the new potential Prime Minister was saying about music education.
Yes.
And how it's become too middle class, mm-hmm. you know, and musicians are like becoming rarer and rarer. And for some reason, the current government hate self-employed people and they hate musicians. So if you're both of those things, which you have to be if you're going to be a musician, you're in trouble. Yeah. And it's been very difficult. So I'm not saying it should be easy to be a professional artist, but there needs, you know, I think... For me, it's just about there should be music everywhere, high quality music, and musicians should be more highly regarded as for their social function as they are now.
I agree.
You know?
I totally agree. And I think there was this huge thing, particularly around lockdown, where the art industry was kind of, don't be in the art industry, that's it. There was posters and, yeah. Yeah, retrain, yeah. Go and do something else. Go into another thing. And I'm thinking, well, no, because everything we do and everything we consume and everything we love that brings us joy generally starts out in the art industry, regardless of what area of the art industry it is. You know, people sat on their bottoms watching telly. All of that is film direction, lighting, you know, storyboarding, you know, music production, writing. And yet that was completely and still is, I feel, you know, undervalued, unappreciated. And it's almost frowned upon. I was talking to some performers in the last episode who, you know, they do fire and stuff like that. Again, completely underappreciated for the amount of work and effort and things that they put into that. I think being a mum and you being a parent, I think it's quite scary in a way that if this doesn't change and if we don't get a new Prime Minister in, where that leaves the future for our kids, because my little boy is just starting to get into music. We've got a daft little app and it's little singing monsters, and he clicks on it. Oh, and
I know it. Yeah,
you know it, and he starts creating stuff on there. And then
you can actually write on it, can't you?
Yeah, you can write.
I'll tell
it.
You a good one. You might know it's called Thumb Jam.
Right, I think he's got it.
Thumb Jam's really interesting. It's like you can basically pick instruments, and it puts a scale. So your phone becomes like. It looks like a xylophone almost. So you move your finger up the scale and it plays those notes, and you can vibrate it to get vibrato and stuff. And it's quite interesting. And you can record on it. So you can make little loop recordings and add layer instruments. And you can, obviously, if you set it to a certain scale, you can't play a wrong note.
So
it ends up being quite, you know, diatonic and maybe it's even tuneful. And that's a good way to get them into it. But I think there's definitely a new government coming.
Oh, yes.
But it's you know, it's a very strange time we're in, really.
It is. It feels strange. And, you know, I think, do you think your children, and excuse me for asking this, do you think your children are interested in music? Do you think they will, or do you think it was something like we did, like we were saying, when the personal research starts at 13? Do you think that's when you may see some influence?
Well, I mean, the eldest is 11. She has been doing performing arts. She goes like performing arts. It's not a club, it's a school. It's every weekend. She's already done a few performances at the Empire. She's obsessed with music. She always has been. She's been singing since she was 1 year old. And her voice is becoming amazing. And she's interested in acting. And she's very competitive. She's doing like her Lambda, you know, the London Amateur. Yeah. She's got level 2 now. And then the little ones are, I mean, Nico, my daughter, who's 6, is like always kind of, she's got ants in her pants, basically, at all times. and more of an interest in music. Solly's, music's around it. I mean, I'm always playing the piano in the house, you know, and I don't like, I would never kind of coerce them into learning an instrument. I mean, Solomon wants to learn the cello, but that's just because of Perfect Peter from Horrid Henry. It's just like, I'm not buying you a cello, mate. We're not doing that. But, you know, this guitar lily over there, if you're interested, you could play that. Because, you know, I think it'd be easier to play a miniature guitar than a cello.
Yes, because the cello is notoriously hard.
Of course it is. It's a microtonal instrument, so we'll be starting them out on the microtonal instruments.
Yeah, that's a hard place to start, I can tell you that now. I think that's fab, because obviously that again, like I said, I'm not going to, you know, my child, I don't want him to go into formal yet. I think he needs that play and that understanding and to be able to touch instruments. And, you know, sometimes he will, you know, I'll let him have my bass and he can just sit and have a tootle on it. And, you know, the drums, he loves the drums, just give him the drumsticks, go for it. I'm not going to go, you're not doing that right, keep it in that time, just play, explore. And I think that's key to art in itself. Didn't you, when you said you obviously started out on piano, I heard a birdie told me that you got guitar because your brother got a guitar. Was that something?
Dave, who eventually, well, he got a guitar and I kind of stole it off him in a sense. But I was interested in the guitar because of classic rock. And I heard Sunshine of Your Love by Cream. And it wasn't actually the guitar part, but it was the bass and the drums, really, that kind of got me. It was the whole thing. You can't really separate them, but it was actually the bass guitar line and Ginger Baker's kind of throbbing floor tom. And I'm like, that's cool. Like that was my kind of way in. And then Davey got like this guitar and my dad organized for us to have a couple of lessons from one of his friends who, my dad was a retired nurse. And he had a colleague who was a rock musician and he came through and gave me a few lessons and learning a few riffs and that. And suddenly Davey became interested in the drums, but he didn't have a drum kit. He just had drumsticks and he sat on his bed and played along to Queen and all sorts of stuff. And he'd done that for a while. And then when he sat behind a drum kit, he could play it automatically. And he did his first gig when he was 11 years old. So we had a band in school. We were an Oasis covers band, believe it or not. And so we were like Britpop, and there was another band in school who were a grunge band. So obviously Britpop and grunge were happening at the same time. So they were doing like American influence, and we were like literally playing Oasis covers and nothing else. And we had a kind of friendly rivalry with them.
A kind of love-hate rivalry kind of going on. I love it.
Yeah, and they were doing, like, you know, Nirvana and what's a band? Self-Esteem.
Yes.
You know, that kind of, and what we did, there was a battle of the bands, and my brother, who was only, like, 11, it was really sneaky. He went just before they played, he snuck behind stage and put the bass guitarist's tune, bass guitar completely out of tune, like detuned. And we didn't have like pedal tuners. So he just got on stage and did Smells Like Teen Spirit. And obviously, it was just so out of tune.
Just flat. Everyone's like, oh.
It's like, wow. I was like, that's so vicious for an 11 year old.
For an 11-year-old, yes, but I like it though. It's sneaky and I like it.
I think it's unfair.
It's unfair. I mean, that's the thing nowadays, technological wise, you would. The bands that I have done setups for and stuff like that, tune it before you go on. But some people don't. Some people just trust in the whole. Like I know they set up like a couple of hours before and do sound check and then just be like, oh yeah, no, heat, temperature, everything like that.
I tune in between every song.
Do you tune
I shouldn't really, but it's just the habit I have. I suppose if the last chord is in tune, then the first chord of the next one will be in tune. But I've kind of built it up whereby I have to fine-tune the guitars at all times, and it's a bit daft, really.
If it works for you, it works for you. And I think that's
playing. It's automatic. It's like an automatic thing. I might try and get rid of that.
No.
And be a little bit more kind of free.
Spontaneous. I don't think you should. I think you should keep it if it's something that's comfortable, and being comfortable when you're performing, I think, is a huge thing. I
know it's just that awkward moments between songs are like, that's why we started to develop quite a rapport with each other in the crowd, to kind of make use of that time in between songs, which is a crucial moment, because there's obviously the songs, but then there's the atmosphere in between the songs. You build the gig with that. The songs are there. They're almost automatic moments, but the bit in between, that's where spontaneity can come in, and that's where you can really make a good atmosphere, you know, or in a more intense atmosphere, or whatever you want. We tend to be quite like informal, and we chat to each other and take the mic out of each other.
But that's good, because that's important, and I think this is where a lot of the bands I love, and I love seeing live, they have this amazing connection with the audience, but it's not a forced connection. It's not just a woo. It's that whole organicness between them, the audience, the band, what they do. Some of them are dancing on stage, you know, some of the heavier, you know, more gothy EBM type bands, you'll see them bounce all over the stage, and I could not do that for love and money. I couldn't get on a stage properly myself, if I'm honest. Do you think the future heads, when you played, because you played some huge gigs, was that daunting? Did you find that daunting? Did you find that overwhelming?
Well, we support the Foo Fighters at Wembley Stadium, right? The first night that they ever played Wembley Stadium. And we went on first, and Supergrass went on second. And because the Futureheads and Supergrass at the time were Dave Grohl's favourite British bands, right? And it was genuine, you know what I mean? You could tell, because he's the type of person who knocks on your dressing room door and comes in and hangs out with you for 45 minutes. And you're like, looking at him like, Jesus Christ, this guy is just incredible. And this is how nervous I was when we played Wembley Stadium. So we got announced to the stage by Zane Lowe, right?
Right.
And we come out of like the tunnel where the footballers would come out. Yeah. But there's like, you're talking like, I don't know, 40 meters, 50 meters to the stage. So everyone put your hands together for the Futureheads. And then I just start sprinting. And the other lads were walking. So I arrived at my microphone and they were still halfway up the bloody ramp, because I was so nervous. I just wanted to get on stage. It was so embarrassing. But you know, like in the early days, I kept on having this experience where I kept on losing my voice on the day of the gig. It became this like psychological issue. And I was, as the gigs were getting more high profile, you know, like, oh, we're bringing an agent along to see you today. We're going to, you know what I mean? Like, we're bringing a producer along. I started to have these like psychological problems. And then when I got over that, suddenly the gigs, certain gigs would make me nervous. But after a while, and it's a shame really, stop becoming nervous.
Right.
And then there's not the same energy there. Because it's the nervousness that becomes your performance. You know, if you're not full of energy when you go on stage, where's it coming from? It has to come from the crowd. The crowd can give you energy, but the way you get that going is by having energy to give to them, and then it goes back and forth. And that's the dynamic of being on stage. So when we'd done like, you know, 1,200 gigs and, you know, had a, you know, maybe semi-jaded experience of the music industry and felt like being like kind of chewed up and spat out, blah, blah, blah. It gets difficult to be authentic in that way for anyone, you know. And that's why, you know, so many people burn out or become, you know, or you're talking about Fleetwood Mac, you know, the drug addictions, scandal, whatever, not caring as much, all of that stuff is... It's an occupational hazard, I think.
It is. That whole, as you mentioned, sort of the drug addiction, the whole kind of where the energy's coming from, things like that. I think that's a really important thing to bring to it, because a lot of bands now are promoting, not promoting that, you know, it's gone from that whole, you know, industry of trying to push that in your face to a very mental health responsible, you know, a lot of the bands now are, you know, promoting sobriety and promoting, you know, for example, Jeff Waters, he still talks about how sober he is, you know, and how, you know, that really changed and influenced his music. And I think that's a really important thing to bring to it as well. I think that talking about things. I do want to ask you before we wrap, there's a couple of things I want to go through with you. Your nerdy influence, you've already mentioned your nerdy music influences, and I am over the moon we've managed to have that conversation, because this is something I have been dreaming of, having a conversation like that. Other nerdy influences, things that drive you, Barry?
And food, cookery.
Cookery.
So I'm like probably an equal food nerd as I am music nerd. That's to some degree. I think so. I'm obsessed with cookery and food. I became, when I realized I'd lost my hobby, which was music, to become a professional musician, my new hobby became cookery. And then that became my profession. And that got me back into music. I think you've got to have I'm very particular, a bit of a nightmare in the kitchen, in the house. I'm a bit of a nightmare.
Your thing, my kitchen, I'm taking over, I'm doing this.
And I'm very opinionated about how you should, the techniques you should use for cookery.
Well, I will never ever cook around you ever, because I am awful. But that's so cool. I think this whole nerdy, this passion, you know, that is what I love about life in general, finding people's passions, taught them about it, even if it's not something that I am, you know, skilled at or my area, that love for something. Any music bands that I've obviously mentioned Henderson, but any music bands, anything that, you know, drove you when you were young, something that, you know, you got that album and went, oh my word, this is like,
well, probably the Velvet Underground were like quite a big early influence. When I was a paper boy, I used to have like a little Walkman, and I would listen to them a lot, their, you know, the first album, White Light, White Heat, etc. And I loved, it was, you know, in the 90s, it was a great time for music. All the Britpop bands, I was more like kind of British side of it all. I loved Pulp and Blur and Oasis, and Supergrass came along, and that was like, whoa, they're like my age. They were just a little bit older than me, and they were making this incredible punk-influenced music. And then it was getting into new wave punk bands like Wire, Devo, XTC, where I started to develop my own voice in music. And that was, it was kind of made sense for me to be making, it felt like I should be making quite fast music. And, you know, the punk thing, singing in your own voice, own accents, and then combining that with like some kind of, I love, you mentioned Steve Reich, you know, and like Philip Glass and John Adams. I got into that when I was a semi-pretentious teenager, you know, it's like, and now I'm like, wow, minimalism's like so amazing. And so like put it all together. But these days I'm just obsessed with playing the piano, and I've got this like thick book of like 1500 songs. It's like, from the 1920s to like the 1980s, and I just sit with that and like look at, especially like the early Disney compositions from the 1930s, is stuff like When You Wish Upon a Star, and I'm like playing this stuff going, my god, this is amazing, you know. And they're using, you know, extended chords and symmetrical chords and all this, like the stuff that really comes from the classical tradition,
yes,
is there. And that was pop music then, and now you've got like pop songs with two chords.
Yeah.
And it's like there's 15 people credited as writing them. And I'm like, how does that work?
How? Yeah.
It's like, is everyone like writing half a line each? You know what I mean? It's like you get these masterpiece compositions from the 20th century written by one person, or maybe two, and there's like 35 chords. And it's like in three different keys. And now we're like, then that's it. It's like, okay, I mean, I'm not being a snob, and this, you know, it's interesting to think that, because when I did my master's, one of my studies was like looking at the biggest selling songs of each year from a taxonomy of 25, or maybe even more categories. So it's like, what key is it in? Is it major? Is it minor? Is there a modulation? How many people wrote it? Bloody blah, you know what I mean? And it wasn't until 1985, I think,
that the first biggest song in bigger selling song was in a minor key. So between like 1954 and for that period of 30 years, every time there was the biggest selling song, it was major and bright. And yes. Then 1980s happened. What happened in the 1980s? Thatcher, AIDS, strikes. Suddenly darkness comes into the mainstream. Obviously, there's always minor songs and minor chords being used. But then since then, music is becoming more simplistic, much darker, much faster. And it's like it's some kind of insight into the psyche of society.
Yes, societal referencing it. It kind of moves with, I mean, I'm a big fan of Star Trek, and that does the same. It moves with society's perceptions and political ideals and stuff like that. I mean, you mentioned the piano an awful lot. Obviously, you wrote Melody, and that is a really artistic album. It's just, it's wonderful. Oh, it's so artistic and lovely. It's just, it's probably not the right adjective, but so, it's got local feel as well. Are you going to be doing anything else solo coming up? Yeah. Or?
I've just finished one.
Have you?
I'm doing I'm doing an album called Miner's Ballads, and it is some kind of cross between Melody and the more kind of acoustic stuff the Future Heads do. But it's based on mainly songs from the mining tradition of the northeast of England. So it's like stuff like Come All You Colliers, Miner's Life, and it's, I've recorded it in my studios in what we call Birdland, and I self-produced it, which is a big deal for me because, you know, I've worked with some of the best producers and I never paid any attention to what they were doing. You know, they never drew me into becoming interested in engineering.
Yes.
You know, and I really regret that, you know, like being in a recording studio with Paul Epworth or Youth or various others. And me never really kind of going, so what's a compressor then? So I had to teach myself all of that like later on. And I've managed to, I think, do a decent enough job of producing this album to make me feel like I can do that, you know, because I've worked as a producer with other bands, but I always needed an engineer, you know. But I like being a hands-on producer that is actually involved in, I think the setup's important and the choice of microphones and keeping an eye on the levels, you know. So now I'm like interested. I've just produced an acoustic album with Red London. I've worked with a great local band called Dead Wet Things, who are like kind of like they're all like musos really. And then the singer Pablo is like from the East End of Sunderland, which is like the old school Sunderland, and he's proper Magham. And he's got these streetwise, and he's from quite a raw world, you know, and putting all that together, like, it's brilliant. Who else? I've been looking at working with different people, but I'm excited because I'm going to release a solo album this year. The Future Heads is going to release Best Of this year.
Excellent.
Yeah, in part with Cherry Red.
Awesome.
Yeah, so and we're really pleased about that. And we're also, I'll tell you, even though we haven't announced it, we're going to make a Christmas album, like.
You're going to do a Christmas album? Because didn't you do a big Christmas performance as well?
We played the Boiler Shop, and we've got a Christmas song called Christmas is Better in the 1980s, but we've learned a few extra ones for this song last December for this gig, and now we're like, you know what? Why don't we just record like a mini album of Christmas songs just for a laugh? And we're going to do that.
I love it. It's great. I think we need that.
You'll probably like one of the choices, well, some of them, but Danny Elfman.
Yes.
What's This?
Yes. Yes.
We're doing that. That's in three keys. It's really hard.
I can imagine it is, but I think it's there's really going to be a lot. It's really hard. There's going to be a lot of nerds now. We're going to be like that. Oh my word. Yes.
Well, if they are real nerds, I dare them to try and learn how to play the bloody thing. It's ridiculous.
Well, I am not going to be able to do that. So I'm not a real nerd. No, honestly, I think it's amazing. And like you said, obviously the Future Heads are doing that. Any live shows coming up that you are going to be going out on the road or?
Yeah, we're playing one soon, actually. I think it's the 5th of April. We're playing a strange and unusual gig at the City Hall in Sunderland, which is like a new building where obviously the local council's based. It's a company called they call it the Caber. The Caber organise these unusual gigs. We're doing that. We've got a bunch of festivals. To be honest, I'm not really one for memorising them dates that we've got, you know, but you can find our information on social media. But a load of fezzies, I would say, well, a fair amount of festivals. And, yeah, I mean, it's a very, very much a part-time thing for us, you know, in terms of what we commit to it time-wise. But we always, whenever we have a festival, we always rehearse. And at the end of every rehearsal, we always say, we didn't really need to rehearse, did we? And then we're like, no, but we always still do. Because it's like, I can't bear the idea of going on stage at a festival having not had a rehearsal, because we used to be so tight and it was so such a constant part of our lives. You know, touring bands don't rehearse. They just make albums and gig. There's no rehearsals when you're gigging every day and the band's so tight. We never really get to that point unless we do three gigs in a row. And we very rarely do more than two gigs in a row because we'll just go away for the weekend.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So like, and I don't know, I don't think we'll ever do any slogging tours where like we'll go away for 3 months to get that level of tightness. So we have to rehearse, which always just seems like a bit of a pain.
No, I mean, it's necessary though, isn't it? Like one
it
of the
is,
bands
but it's so like functional. It's so functional and like, you know, just like it's not really creative, you know. Rehearsing is the opposite. It's the opposite of creative. It's just like mechanical. Yeah. So it feels like I'd rather be making new music, but you know, we're a legacy band with like six albums and we kind of rely upon our back catalogue to get us work. So we ought to our commitments to be as good as possible.
To put that effort in. I mean, it, like you say, one band last year, they did 116 shows in a year. Now, by the end of that, you know, that's going to be smooth because you're going to be, or you're going to be so exhausted, it's going to be the opposite. You know, it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, it's huge. But like you say, it's keeping that your hand in with it. And I think it's going to be amazing. It's going to be amazing to see back, because obviously any time I hear a Futurehead song, I'm back in Q Club in Sunderland. You know, I am there and it's like, you know, it's fabulous. And I'm so pleased that you are going to be out and about doing stuff on your new album. Again, it being so local. And the whole mining thing as well. You know, my family, my granddad was a miner. You know, that was a huge part of my childhood, growing up, understanding all of that. And keeping it local and what you do, how you put on a place for, you know, smaller bands and bringing new different types of music. The last thing I ever ask anybody, and you can just say flat out no, is there anything you want to ask me while you've got me? Anything at all? Any honest, 100% honest answer? Anything?
Is that a short scale bass behind you?
Yes.
What is it, Bronco?
No, it is just a Squire. It's a Squire Precision. It's a short scale because I am tiny, nice. And my other bass is...
That looks like a Firebird.
Yeah.
Short scale Firebird.
That's a full scale, and I am only 5'3".
That's beast. So why did you pick up the bass?
Bass, my uncle's a bass player. He plays, he's played in bands since I was a little girl. So I used to go around his and pick up his bass and play. Yeah. I used to get a tennis racket and I used to jump on his bed while he was practicing. And it became a love of mine. You know, I learned violin and then I went to guitar a little bit, but guitar felt very, I was used to, it sounds daft, I was used to four strings. Four strings felt very natural to me. So I got bought a Stag bass, just like a normal make one, which I still have. It's being repaired at the moment. And then I bought the Thunderbird because I loved it. Like it's beautiful.
It's cool looking guitar. But one of our students had one and it snapped the head off it.
Oh my God, how?
Just one of those kind of accidental moments, you know, fell over badly, had a bad fall, like a nana.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like suddenly he's like, can anyone fix me bass? I'm like, oh, I don't know if I know anyone who can fix that, mate. But he did eventually get it fixed. But I used to play bass in a band when I was a teenager and I loved it. You know, it's really hard though, like physically, you know, it's like knacks your hands. I remember once we were recording, the Futureheads were recording a session at a studio called The Exchange in Camden. And I think that was with Paul Epworth, and we did like a bunch of our first album there. And I opened one of these cupboards, and there was a double bass in there. And I stood in this cupboard for hours playing the double bass, the bass line for a Tom Waits song called Step Right Up. Bum, bum, ba-dum, bum, bum, ba-dum, bum, bum. And honestly, the next day I couldn't move my arm. I was like, what was done to my arm? You know, like I think I practically kind of destroyed my own body trying to learn how to play the bass.
Yeah, it's hard. That's why I've got the short scale and a little bit lighter, because at 5'3", I'm about 8 stone. If I play the Thunderbird for too long, I can physically feel myself sort of like leaning over and just trying to generally sort of maneuver it. Mm. But I like the sound of it for recording. I find it's got that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But that's my day to day.
Practice bass, yeah.
Yeah, practice bass needs setting up. It's got a.
Does it? You know,
yeah, what the action. Meaning? Well, the action's take like. High. Yeah, the action's. I can get me fingertips under the action now, so it needs restringing, resetting up.
You need someone to adjust the truss rod.
Yeah,
which is something that you need like a doctor to do that.
Luckily, we've got a few in the northeast, so I know I'm going to take it to.
Do you know Peter Wilson? Do you know him?
I've not heard of him. No, I probably do know him.
Peter Wilson's in a great band called Johnny Seven.
Yes.
Yeah, and he works with the Future Heads. He's our guitar tech, and he's qualified to touch his truss rod.
So maybe that's where I need to take her.
I think you need to do like a five. It's a bit like learning how to do sushi. You know, like you've got to do 5 years doing intonation before you're allowed to touch the truss rod. It's a bit like if you're going to be a sushi chef, you need to do 5 years on the rice before you're allowed to cut the fish.
Before you're allowed to go near it. Yes, my Patricia, as it is aptly named, because obviously Patricia Morrison had a black, black bass. She needs some attention. So maybe that's where I'll be like, help, just get me truss rod sorted.
But careful.
don't put it in the wrong hands. Barry, thank you so much for your time. I know you are a very busy person. You have been a joy to speak to. I have really enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me.
I know. Thank you for coming on, and I wish you all the best for future. And I'll probably pop into the Peacock next time I'm in Sunderland.
Well, give us a shout. We're open Thursday to Sunday, mind, so don't come on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, because it'll be closed.
And then I'll be like, oh, it should. Oh. You take care. Yeah. Thank you very much, Barry.
All right. All the best. Cheers.
Over and out from Gigs Up North.
Okay.
Be good. Behave. And if you can't behave, don't get caught. See you later.